And welcome back to Coast, wherever you may be, Hawaii, Las Vegas, Detroit, Cleveland, Tampa. You know we are in more cities than most radio stations around the world. Tonight, Robert Moss joins us as we talk about dreaming, the secret history of dreaming, the three only things, tapping the power of dreams, coincidence, he writes, and imagination. Up next, Robert Moss on Coast to Coast AM. Robert Moss, pioneer of active dreaming, born in Australia. He survived three near-death experiences in childhood and first learned the ways of a traditional dreaming people through his friendship with Aborigines. And here he is right now, back on Coast to Coast. Robert, my friend, how are you?
Good to be with you, George.
Always a pleasure. Man, you've been busy since we last chatted, well over a year
running
ago.
Running around, teaching people how to dream again.
I have to tell you that In my entire life, I have never been so tuned in to dreams and our abilities to do things in a dream state than I have been over the last 6 months or so. And I don't know why, Robert. I don't know what's happening to me or to the collective consciousness, but something's happening.
One of the things that's happening, George, I'm delighted to hear that, by the way. And, of course, you live a dream life anyway, don't you, on this show?
Yes,
one of the things going on with you, maybe, my friend, and certainly with our society, is, you know what, we need better sources of information on everything. You know, our ordinary sources have failed us. Look at the state our world is in. Look at how we are blindsided by mass events for which our leadership is completely unprepared. One of the things that ancient and indigenous peoples have always understood about dreaming is we have a radar system available to us that is better than anything the Pentagon or NASA can come up with. It shows us the possible future. It puts us in touch with other dimensions of the real and with sources of guidance in those dimensions. And that radar system is called dreaming. And it's available to us any night. It's available when we're wide awake too and learn to pay attention to synchronicity, coincidence, symbolic pop-ups from the world. So we are in dire straits. We know that. That's not news. It's not news to your listeners. It's not news to anybody who's worried about their mortgage or their job right now. So we need sources that have been considered unusual and extraordinary in our culture to get us through.
Now, a lot of people are using their dreams, tapping into this power. And you've got a couple latest works out, The Secret History of Dreaming and the Three Only Things, Tapping the Power of Dreams, Coincidence, and Imagination. Now, I'm going to have you sell me on coincidence because, as you know, Robert, I don't believe in coincidence, but I believe in everything else that you've written here.
Well, you don't believe it's only coincidence, really. You know, coincidence is when an event in the outside world and our inner sense of meaning join together. They join up and they give us a signal. I regard coincidence as a secret handshake from the universe. An old way of talking about coincidence was to say it's God's way of remaining anonymous. And I like that idea, too. We all know the impression. I mean, I can give you a theory about this, but let me just evoke the feeling that so many of us get. You know, you feel sometimes that there is an unseen hand patting you on the back, saying right on, and alternatively, sometimes you feel as if a door is being slammed in your face again and again and again, knocking you back. You know, I think it's like this, George. I think that, you know, the surface reality of our lives, our conscious logic of events and linearity is not all that's going on in the world. There is a hidden order of events. There is a deeper logic and becomes apparent to us through coincidence or synchronicity. I steer by it every day. For example, first thing in the morning, I will be alert to notice the first vanity plate on the car in front of me, you know, that day. And I will play the game that is a message to me. It might be large or small. It might be interesting or uninteresting. The first vanity plate or the first bumper sticker or the first logo or the first unusual thing crossing my path of vision on the road may be guidance for me for the day.
You know, Robert, you've been a history teacher, a foreign correspondent, a magazine editor, a tremendously selling novelist. I was going to say a puppet, a poet, a pawn, and a king. It's part of a song.
But I'd be called worse.
You also say that you're a dream teacher.
Yes.
Now, how did this evolve for you?
Well, it began in my childhood, and then I came back to it. You know, Scott Fitzgerald said that there's no second act in American lives. Well, he was wrong about that, and he was certainly wrong about Australian lives, because there have been a few acts in my life, and I expect a few more. I started out as a kid understanding that dreaming is real and it takes us to a real place that is very important, because I was challenged by illness. I mean, I had three experiences that today we would call near-death experiences. We didn't have that language when I was a kid in Australia. The doctor said, oh, poor kid, he died again and he came back, didn't he? And the gift of those experiences was a knowledge and familiarity with the world beyond the ordinary one that for me was just so. It was there. I'd been there. I knew about it. Awfully hard to talk about those things, George. Growing up in the 1950s in a conservative military family in white bread and white True. Bread section of Australia. Very hard to talk about any kind of spirits that didn't come out of a bottle. Very hard to talk about dreams. One of the first people I met who could validate my experiences was an Aboriginal kid who was very matter-of-fact about, oh, yeah, you know, we get sick, we go to a different place until we get better. Oh, yeah, yeah, we dream the future. We dream about the dead. So I was hearing from an Indigenous person that what I was doing was not exotic from their point of view. So life goes on, you do different things. I mean, my life choices were very much guided by my dreams. I used to dream in ancient Greek. I'd keep a dictionary of classical Greek by my bedside before I ever studied any Greek. That probably guided the process by which I became a lecturer in ancient history. My first job in life was as a professor, an assistant professor in American terms of ancient history at Australia National University. Dreams guided me as a journalist. I believe they saved my life on more than one occasion from death in Vietnam and other places. But then I only became public about this in a big way 20 years ago. It sounds like a long stretch now. You know, George, I'd moved to a farm in upstate New York. I set up with the commercial fast track I'd been on, needed to get away, needed to put down some roots. And I started dreaming in another language I did not understand. It turned out to be an archaic form of the Mohawk Indian language. I studied that language with the help of native speakers, and that is the moment at which I decided life was about more than I had understood and been living, and I started following a different path, which today I describe as a path of the dream teacher, someone who is trying to help people in our world to understand that dreaming is real, it matters, it's important, the source of healing, guidance, and fun, and it's for every day.
Truly the connection with, I think, I don't want to call it the supernatural or the paranormal. I think it's all very normal. We just, you know, a lot of people just aren't aware of this, Robert. But I think dreams are that connection. They're that bridge to that other side, don't you?
I think that's exactly right, and I like the way you put that very much. None of this is supernatural. It may be paranormal in the sense that it goes beyond the range of normal, common, conscious, everyday experience, but all of it is entirely natural. And it's about the fact, really, George, that we live in a multidimensional universe. You know, from one point of view, we're bound by clock time. You and I are looking at the clock in terms of what we do on your radio show. Things seem to follow one after another, click, 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 click. But our science is telling us what dreamers and mystics and shamans have always understood, which is we live in a world of multiple dimensions. You know, superstring theory posits, what, 11 dimensions, physical dimensions,
yeah,
hidden from ordinary perception? How would you know that if you're not a scientist speculating, giving yourself a headache over this stuff? Well, you might know it by dreaming. Maybe in dreams you go there. Maybe in dreams, for example, you go to parallel worlds where you see alternate time tracks, a time track in which the Soviet Union still exists, a time track in which you're married to your ex, etc. Dreamers do that. So, as you say, this is a bridge. This dreaming is a bridge. It's an everyday bridge. We can all use it to the moreness of life. I mean, that's the way a friend of mine puts it, a very spiritual and also very simple and practical woman. The moreness of life. Dreaming connects us to the moreness of everything.
These three death experiences that you had as a child, you want to tell us what happened on each case? And they probably tuned you up for what you are today.
Well, they probably did. As I say, I had to lie low about them for a while, but I now talk about them quite openly. I died for the first time at the age of three. My mother had taken me to West Australia to meet her family. My great aunt was an opera singer, the friend and understudy of Dame Nellie Melba, the famous opera star. She was also a medium in a quiet way. She didn't make a lot of noise about it, but, you know, she read the tea leaves in the old-fashioned way. She turned white when she read my tea leaves and would not talk to us, and I later understood why. I died that year. I died in Tasmania in a bitterly cold winter. My parents had to take me to Queensland to the warm to get out of that. I don't remember very much about that, George, except that I know my life changed radically. I was a very happy, cheerful, strapping, strong little boy. For the next 8 years, my life was one of the darkness of sick rooms for 6 months out of 12, of isolation, of loneliness, and of unfettered reading, imagination, and dreaming. The experience I remember most clearly came when I was 9 years old. I'd been rushed for an emergency appendectomy to a hospital in Melbourne. I found myself wandering out of the operating theater without quite knowing what was happening, without quite realizing that I'd left my body behind. I saw my mother grieving in the hall. I didn't want to see her grief. I was drawn to a window and a happy scene of the beach along the way, and I found myself traveling through the window in my second body, in my subtle body, my energy body, drawn to an amusement park, which was down there on the seafront in Melbourne, called Luna Park. Drawn through the big clown face at the gate of Luna Park, and then finding myself drawn somewhere else, forgetting what was going on, living with a different people, very beautiful, very pale, very elongated, living somewhere, it seemed, within the world, forgetting where I'd come from, living a life, growing up, becoming a father and a grandfather and an elder and maybe some kind of shaman of this people, and then being burnt and rising on the smoke of the cremation and floating back unwillingly to the body of a terrified young 9-year-old on a bed in an operating theater in Melbourne. That is my recollection, and I've now written about it. I've written about it in one of my books. I think I wrote most about this in my book called Dreamways of the Iroquois. So I'm unashamed and unabashed about talking about these things. An amazing experience, perhaps one very hard to talk about or live with for a long time, except for this. I knew at that moment, age 9, that there are worlds beyond the ordinary one. They are real. We can go there. One of the things I've learned later on is it's not necessary to go through the extremity of a near-death experience to do these things. We can learn to travel in safer and more practical ways to the deeper world and bring back gifts.
So good for you. Good for you. There's so many things I want to talk with you about tonight, Robert, and some incredible new revelations here that we've never heard before about Sigmund Freud and some things like that. But let's talk about, in terms of dreams, some of the current events that are going on right now, because they seem to be in everybody's mind right now. First of all, Barack Obama shall lead us for the next 3 to 4 years in the White House in terms of a direction that this country is going to take. Do you have to be a dreamer, even as a president, to go the right way?
Well, I remember what Bush Sr. said once, that he had a hard time with the vision thing. I think we are learning in our world what the absence of the vision thing can do. I mean, it can bring us down. It can bring us down beyond what we thought possible. We need dreamers. I'm not going to make any kind of political statement for or against anybody in this conversation, but we need dreamers. We need people who can envision a future, see different possibilities, see beyond the ordinary reach of the ordinary imagination. And one of the things I would say about Barack Obama, who I do not know personally, is that he's a dreamer in several senses. And one of the senses that is relevant to the discussion is he's a man who clearly has long paid attention to his night dreams, you know, the sleep dreams that are the aspect of dreaming that most people most easily understand. I was looking again at two dreams from his earlier life that he wrote about in his first book, Dreams from My Father, and they are really, really interesting. And regardless of political preferences, I think both of these dreams speak to all of us in human ways. The first dream was a year after his father's death, and you know, his father was absent for most of his life. He grew up without a dad and, of course, felt about that deeply. And in his dream, he's traveling on a bus, and there's an older white man sitting next to him, and they get off at a grand hotel, at a stop at a grand hotel, and the old guy sits down at the piano and starts trying to play the piano and morphs into a lovely little smiling black girl who is playing on the black and white keys. And then Obama's back on the bus and he dozes off and he wakes up inside his dream. This is really interesting. He wakes up inside his dream. Some of us have had that experience.
Yes.
And now he's dropped off at a courthouse-like building where a judge and a lawyer are arguing over whether his dad should stay in jail. The judge wants to let Obama's dad out of jail. The lawyer quotes precedent and detail and all this lawyerly stuff about how dad should stay in jail. And Obama goes to the cell, opens the lock on his father's cell door, embraces his father, who is very weak and thin and wrapped in a cloth like a loincloth, and they hug. And dad says, "I've always wanted to tell you how much I love you." And we feel at that moment there is closure, emotional closure in the whole situation. And Obama tells his dad, "We can leave the jail together, but dad will not go." This is the dream, the first dream he reports. He wakes from it weeping. And my goodness, I mean, in human terms, I have to feel something for a guy, you know, heading for politics. I mean, he wasn't yet senator from Illinois.
Right.
Heading for public life, who has the guts and the decency and humanity to talk about an experience as deep as that, which many of us who have had unresolved family issues can resonate with. In that dream is the understanding that some kind of closure and emotional blessing is possible beyond the apparent barrier of death. And I am very interested that the United States is going to have a guy in the White House who not only understands that kind of thing, but is clearly prepared to talk about it.
Were there other presidents in the White House who were dreamers?
Obama is absolutely not the first dreamer in the White House. This I found fascinating. Of course, I grew up in Australia, and American history wasn't a big part of my school education.
Right.
You know, we're a product of the British Commonwealth over there, you know. So I
Unfortunately, Robert, it wasn't a big part of most American educational systems either.
the funny thing is, I've discovered, because I've gone deep into some aspects of American history, particularly colonial and revolutionary history, and this kind of thing, you know, the role of dreaming and coincidence in American history, I found a lot of Americans actually do seem to be somewhat undereducated about what the heck has gone on in this country since the beginning. Anyway, you go back to the founding fathers. I find this absolutely fascinating. This is an important section in my new book, The Secret History of Dreaming. You know, among those founding fathers were people who were dreamers, of course, in the sense that they could envision a new kind of society, a new kind of free democratic society, a new kind of constitution. But they're also dreamers in the sense that among those founding fathers were guys who spent a lot of time thinking about what was going on in their night dreams, writing about them, and sharing dreams with each other. Now, the exchange between dreamers that I write about in the book in most detail is between John Adams, second president of the United States, and Dr. Benjamin Rush, a physician of Philadelphia, a guy who made a close study of precognitive dreams, dreams of the future, by the way. These guys were trading letters with each other. This mostly went on after Adams had retired from the presidency, but the correspondence is fascinating. I went through it. You'll get a little bit of this in David McCullough's book, but not very much. I mean, you see, for example, how dreams shaped and influenced John Adams's political thinking on all sorts of things. When he's trying to understand what's going on in France with the French Revolution, he has a dream that in front of the great palace at Versailles in France is a huge mob of wild animals that want to tear him apart, and he understands that the French experiment in revolution isn't going as well as the American one from that dream. But the most fascinating exchange in this dream swapping between John Adams and Benjamin Rush involved a dream that Benjamin Rush wrote in a letter to Adams, in which his son gives him a book that is a future history of the United States. Listen to this for a moment, a future history of the United States, seen in a dream. And on the page that Dr. Rush is looking at in his dream, he reads that John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, long estranged, once friends, but long estranged because of political differences, have been reconciled, and that the correspondence between them will inspire generations to come, and that they die on the same day within hours of each other. Now, they die within hours of each other. 17 years. After this dream, which Dr. Rush sent to John Adams and Jefferson died on the same day, July 4th, note the date, July 4th, 1826. The dream was precognitive. The dream involving reading a future history of the United States was precognitive, down to that detail, looking 17 years into the future. I mean, this is amazing stuff. You know, if we have any doubt about the central, vital importance of dreaming in the history of everything, take an example like that and be educated.
I think as we get into some more of these types of dreams, too, people are going to realize that they can use them to change their lives, make predictions, maybe get themselves out of a potential problem as well. Do you use it in your own life now, day to day?
I use it day to day. I mean, every day of my life, I pay attention to what I remember from my sleep dreams, or what I notice in the form of coincidence and symbolic pop-ups from the world around me, and I notice what comes to me in those in-between states, like the twilight state. You're not asleep, you're not awake, you're not waking exactly, you're somewhere in between, a liminal state, great state to get creative ideas and to get flashes of intuition. So I work with this all the time. I mean, let me give you a quick story since we've all been thinking
about
it.
Okay, I'll do that right after the break, Robert, okay? We'll be back. For a limited time, we're offering two CDs of an old Art Bell interview with the late Father Malachi Martin. Two different CDs. If you own one, perhaps from ways gone back, and you want the other, subscribe to the After Dark magazine. You'll get both CDs free with your subscription, or when you renew, Just call 1-888-727-5505. It'll make a great gift, by the way. 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back. Robert Moss with us. Robert, you were telling us a story, and then the clock got us.
We're talking about the practical uses of this stuff. So let me give you a couple of personal examples, you know, because I agree with Mark Twain when he says, I don't want to hear about the moon from someone who hasn't been there. So let me give you a couple of practical examples of what paying attention to dreams can do for you. On the most mundane level, you know, a feature of my life is giving workshops, seminars, lectures, et cetera, to do all over the place. So I have a dream, for example, that people cannot hear me in the meeting room because there's an incredibly noisy air conditioner. So I check the room out ahead of time. I find that the AC is so loud that we'd either, you know, have to stifle to death without it or would be inaudible. So I have the seminar shifted in good time to avoid embarrassment on the day. That's a practical kind of rehearsal dream in which you seem to be scouting ahead of yourself. If you get the information straight and do something about it, you can do better. You know, this kind of thing extends to survival, George. I couldn't be talking to you on the radio tonight or doing other things I'm currently doing had I not paid attention about a decade ago to a dream in which it starts out pretty routine and mundane. I'm driving up a hill heading east in the state of New York to the house where I was then living. And then everything stops at a fork in the road. There's a convenience store beyond the fork. Everything stops. Everything gets strange. It goes black and white, and then I'm in some anomalous, bizarre locales and understand in the dream, hey, I've headed into the afterlife, and something tells me, unless I read the message of this dream correctly, this could actually be played out. So when I wake up, actively concerned, I think very carefully about where the action stopped in the dream. It's not vague. It's that fork in that road heading east to that convenience store on the other side. 2 weeks later, I'm driving up that hill. There's a big UPS truck parked on a double yellow on the right, blocking visibility. And I would normally, like most motorists, pull out and go around the UPS truck. But because I'm at the scene where things stopped in the dream, I slow almost to a complete halt and thereby miss a head-on collision with an 18-wheeler coming down the road, blocking the whole of the road at 60 or 70 miles an hour. That's an example of the reason why most human cultures have paid very close attention to dreaming. They have understood that in dreams we get glimpses of the future, and it's not just about precognition and prophecy. It's not just about seeing what's going to happen. It's about seeing things that could happen and using the information to do better. So that's a very practical aspect of dreaming. There's another aspect of dreaming which is maybe even more important. It's this, George. Dreams give us our inner compass. They give us purpose and direction and guidance. They put us in touch with our bigger story. And not to be in touch with that, to be just constantly confused and bewildered by the ups and downs and incidents and clutter of everyday life is an impractical and unsatisfactory way to live. So I look to my dreams for guidance and direction and a reaffirmation of purpose in life.
Now, some people don't remember their dreams, Robert, and are you a believer that everybody does dream at least?
Oh, everybody does dream. I mean, the guys in white coats in the sleep laboratories can tell you that everybody on average, I mean, depends how much sleep you get, I guess, is going to dream in four, five, six, even seven cycles of REM state sleep, which is when the eyelids are fluttering, but is not actually the only state associated with dreaming. There is a case to be made from the functions of the brain during the night that we are dreaming in some sense, thinking in some sense, visioning in some sense for the whole of the night. But of course, I'm the kind of dreamer who doesn't believe that dreaming is only or even fundamentally about sleep. I think you know this. From my point of view, dreaming is about waking up, and you can do that in waking life. I mean, if you start paying attention to signs, correspondences, coincidences around you in the world, you can become a 24/7 dreamer, and you can look at symbolically at things around you and get information that way. But to come to what might be riding with your point, you know, if you're going through a dream drought, relax. Don't beat yourself up. Don't tell yourself either that you're a terrible person because you don't remember your dreams or else that dreams can't exist because you don't remember them. Give yourself a break. I mean, give yourself some time when you're off schedule, off plan, not going to be ripped out of sleep by the alarm clock, to laze or languor in bed for a little bit of time in the morning and see what comes and set yourself an intention for the night. Write down, I'd like to have some fun tonight and remember. I'd like to go to Paris and not pay for the plane ticket. So don't make it a chore. Make it something interesting to do. And play that game of looking at what's going on in the real world around you as if there might be signs and symbols there that are interesting. Play this game. Suppose you've got a question on your mind. You know, you like guidance on something. Who doesn't? We all want guidance on something, right? Say to yourself in your mind as simply and clearly as you can, I would like guidance on fill in the blank, on my job, on the money, on my relationship, and play this game. The first unusual, wacky, unexpected thing that enters your field of perception on the road of life during the day will be a message to you from the world speaking to you like a dream symbol. It's amazing what the world gives you when you play that game. That's one of the central games in my book, The Three Only Things, of course.
Now, let's talk about active dreaming. What is that?
Well, you see, I chose the phrase as a provocation because we think that dreaming is passive. You go to sleep, you have a dream. I mean, active dreaming is about waking up to the fact that there are signs and signals all around you. It's about learning to become a conscious dreamer. This is even better than lucid dreaming. I know you discuss lucid dreaming from time to time on this show. Conscious dreaming is beyond lucid dreaming, George. You start out conscious and you stay that way. So one of the things I teach is how to embark on a dream journey from a conscious state. Stay conscious, have all sorts of fun, do all sorts of things, come back, remember, and bring those gifts back into the world. But active dreaming is also about getting more active with dreams. In the family, in society, in the workplace, learning to share and talk about dreams in ways that are useful, fun, high energy, quick, suited to our Western hurry sickness and result in action. So I've invented a process I call the lightning dream work process. It's a way of talking about stuff, talking about dreams or talking actually about any deep life experience that enables you to get non-authoritarian, non-intrusive feedback and be guided towards helpful action in a very few minutes. We haven't had a process like this in our culture. And that's one of the reasons why dreaming and dream work have not yet become a popular movement. And we are not yet harvesting as much from this as we might and need to do.
Demonstrate this for me, Robert, or give me an example of lightning dream work.
If you wanted to give me, George, to put you on the spot, if you wanted to give me a short experience of any kind from any part of your life, I could demonstrate it with you right now. You tell me a little story from your life, any part of your life.
Oh, it doesn't have to be a dream.
It doesn't have to be a dream. It can be anything at all.
Okay. Let me see. Let me think of something that could be witty or fun out of my life. Okay. Years ago, I was producing a television newscast with my director, who was a dear friend of mine, who since died of cancer, by the way. And we were sitting down eating at our desks. When you're producing a television show, Robert, you don't have time to go out for lunch or dinner. You got to sit there. You got to work. You got to eat. You eat fast. And it's created a havoc for me personally. So jump ahead on this great date, having a great time. I have to learn how to slow myself down when I'm at a dinner table, okay? Because there's nothing worse than going on a date or wherever, friends or whatever you're doing, and you chow it down because you're just used to that, right?
Right.
And anyways, we were trained to eat within 10 minutes because you had to eat, go. You're either on a story, you're, you know, jumping a car, you go to some fire, some shooting. That's the way we were trained. And so I'm having this great time, and I realized that I was already done eating. And the look of the person I was with was priceless and disappointing because, I mean, it was almost as if it was a disastrous evening for that person because it just made me look, I don't know, what's the word when somebody finishes their dinner in 10 minutes when it's a nice restaurant and it's supposed to be slow and quiet? I have since learned, by the way, but
fast foodie, maybe.
That's my story, and I have no idea why I'm telling you this.
Well, isn't that interesting? Okay, George, to play the game, I will first ask you to give the story a title. You know, stories need titles, like movies. Like,
all right.
What's the title of this story?
Moron.
Moron. Well, that's good. Right. Something
me.
Jumps out right away. How are you feeling about this story as you tell it right now? What are your feelings around this?
Embarrassed.
Okay, that's good. Hey, look, I give plaudits to a radio show host who will tell a personal story and feel embarrassed on the air. That's terrific.
I just Say it the way it is.
So that's I'm moving me. Into the if it were my life part of the process. I'm doing a very abbreviated process. I'm going to notice where I'm talking to you. If it were my life, George, I would be proud and pleased with myself that I can tell an embarrassing incident like this with a good sense of humor. And I'm willing to expose myself without any inhibition. I mean, I enjoy that. If it's my life, I enjoy the fact that I can tell this and laugh about it. And I guess the reason, if it's my life, that this might be coming to me now is that there might be some analog, some parallel to this situation of when I was chowing too fast. I'm going to ask myself, where in my life, maybe not only with food, but with other things, am I so rushing through stuff that I'm missing out on savoring the full experience and giving myself and those around me all the pleasure we could enjoy and all the discovery we could enjoy if we could just slow down a little bit and taste everything on the palate, so to speak? And I'm also thinking, if it's my life, George, there's a reason I'm mentioning this episode with my friend who is now deceased, who has now departed, you know, and this might be a real stretch, but I'm also thinking that one of the principal reason why guys, why men have told me dreams over the years, and we're not talking about workshops now, we're talking about guys in a bar, guys in a country club, guys on the job, guys on the bus. The principal reason why men have told me dreams over the years is they have dreamed of a departed friend or family member or their dad. It's the number one reason. So I'm thinking that maybe there is some connection between me and my departed colleague, which I want to think about now. And you know what? Maybe he's going to reach to me in a dream. Those are some of the thoughts that are coming to me. And you'll notice I'm not telling you what it means. I'm not telling you why you came up with that story. I'm saying some of the things that come to my mind that it would mean for me if I came up with that story right now, what its relevance might be. The last part of the game is to say to the person who told the story, so what the heck are you going to do now? Yeah. Is there something you're going to do now to honor this exchange, to honor this memory? You're going to slow down in some way? What is your action plan?
You know, this is fascinating because I am obsessed with time. I have this feeling in my head that the clock is ticking faster and faster and faster. So I just, you know, I just feel as if I have to accomplish so much in a certain time frame, Robert. And that has created personally a problem for me in some cases.
So is there some way in which you could put yourself off the clock from time to time?
I need to do that. I'm trying to do that. Because,
you know, as we're talking, George, I'm literally taking my watch off my wrist and I'm putting it on my desk and I'm not going to look at it. Yes, there's a clock on the wall. Yes, there's a clock on the computer.
I have a watch on my wrist. I have two clocks on my desk here in the cave that I have here. I have another one behind me. I have time everywhere, wherever I am.
Well, you know, you could. I'm not pushing you here. Well, if I am.
Well, I have to have it in some cases. I've got to get us on and off. Right?
You've got to watch the time for your show. But you could do right now as a gesture towards the future. You could take your watch off right now and promise yourself that there will be other moments in life when you have the leisure of not having to wait for the break on the show, when you could take the watch off your mind for a while and let yourself loose.
You know, I go to sleep with a watch on.
You know, you could change that for a start. It's got to be your action plan, not mine. So I'm going to let you think about it. But, you know, when we're doing the lightning dream work, whether we're talking about an episode from life or about a dream, we are never happy until we get the storyteller to come up with an action. And, you know, one action we can always take is to come up with a one-liner, a bumper sticker, a snapper, Mark Twain would say. Is there a phrase that comes to mind out of all this? You came up with a title. What is the one-liner, the bumper sticker, the snapper that comes to your mind out of this discussion?
Slow down.
Yes, slow down. You know, I would write that out and put it on my bathroom mirror.
Yep.
Slow down. Why not?
Maybe the clock isn't ticking as quickly as I think, or maybe I shouldn't be so concerned about it. You know, when I was a kid, I thought, you know, you're going to be 20 years old. George, that's a long ways away. And then when I was 20, I thought 30 was a long ways away. And then 40, and now I'm 58. And I realize, you know what? Every time I was concerned about a decade, it came like that, Robert.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to worry about that anymore. because, you know, these are the...
What a rich discussion. Let me share a quick personal experience. Well, share quickly a personal experience. It wasn't all that quick from last summer. I was in too much of a hurry to get into a swimming pool. I love to swim and don't spend as much time in the water as I would like. And I slipped in an unseen slick of water, did the splits, not good to do at any age, probably, if you're like me, tore up one of the muscles in the quad in my right leg, and managed to avoid surgery. It was something that I could avoid surgery on, but needed to slow down for a bit. So I took myself off deadline. You know, George, I am so grateful, actually, for the accident, which led me to think, okay, I'm not going to push for that deadline this time. I'm going to give myself a little break. And it became for me an example of one of my laws for navigating by coincidence, which is this. And you'll recognize this. You know what this means. So do our listeners. For every setback, look for the opportunity. You know, it's hard sometimes because the setback is so immense, you just can't think that there's any opportunity or gift in it. But I had this accident. I mean, not a huge accident, but a very painful and distressing and impairing one for a while. And I found a gift, and the gift was essentially slow down.
Yeah, you're so true. So true.
They used to say that illness is the Western form of meditation. You know, because we won't slow down, we won't look at things in a more thoughtful and considered way. We have to have the accident or the illness to make us reappraise things. That's true for some of us.
So with this lightning dream work, are you saying people should talk about their dreams openly with their friends and family?
Yes, but the condition for doing that is that you have rules and protocols, make it okay, make it safe, deter people from doing fishing expeditions on each other's life, and give you handrails for sensitive discussions. You know, sometimes the person it's hardest to talk about someone with is your spouse or someone very close to you who thinks they know all your stuff. So you need rules and protocols to make it safe. The lightning dream work process, which I explain in my book, The Three Only Things, is a new game to play. It's fun and it makes it safe and you get some action out of it. It doesn't leave things hanging loose. I mean, one of the reasons that we are detached from our dreams is we don't understand, by and large, how to bring their gifts or their warnings into waking life. We don't like something going on in the night, so we slam the door and say, thank goodness it was only a dream, which is dumb, because if you do that, you're probably going to miss something that's going to bite you in the rear end in waking life. Or we slam the door because we have seen a vision of desire and beauty and happiness and success, which we think we cannot achieve. We can't have that because we'll never meet that person. We can't live in a house like that because we haven't got the money. We can't do that because we're not young enough or good looking enough. So we slam the door and kiss the dream goodbye, instead of recognizing that in our dreams are possibilities. If you see something, you might be able to manifest it. So we need ways to help each other wake up to all of this. And that starts with having quite simply a way of talking about things, which I've given people in what I call the lightning dreamwork process. And as we saw, that's not just about talking about dreams. You can use the same rules to talk about anything.
If we want to accomplish something in real life, can we think about it? I do, before you go to sleep. And something seems to work for you.
I think that's a terrific idea. You know, we can solve things in our sleep even if we don't remember a dream. By thinking and focusing on something, as you just mentioned, George, before going to sleep, we may find that we wake with the guidance, direction, and energy anyway. I mean, a rather smart guy called Einstein was thinking about something on a spring night in 1905. He woke up with a special theory of relativity. Contrary to what some dream books say, there's no evidence that Einstein remembered a dream that morning, as far as I'm aware, but he did have his solution. So, you know, he slept on something and came up with a heck of an interesting solution. We can do the same thing, even if we're not Einstein.
Next hour, I want to talk a little bit about lucid dreaming and your thoughts on whether people can enter other people's dreams. And then we'll get into some of these incredible stories that you've got, that you write about in The Secret History of Dreaming, your new book. Where can you get this book, by the way, The Secret
History
of Dreaming?
Should be coming into all the bookstores right now. I know it's at the online booksellers right now. It's available for the online booksellers. They're shipping. It's arriving in people's mailboxes, and it's coming into the bookstores as we speak.
All right. We'll talk a lot about that. Can people email you questions about dreaming off of your website?
Absolutely, but let me mention that at my website you'll find directions for the online courses that I lead, and probably the easiest way to talk in depth is to sign up for one of those, and I'll discuss things with you in that forum.
Moss, MOSS, dreams.com. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.